opening narration.
Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Introduction.
Welcome to the Akatra Dialogue. Today, we're diving into a figure who, for many years, seemed like a pillar of Wall Street, but was secretly the architect of, well, the largest financial fraud in history, Bernard Madoff.
It's an incredible story. The sheer contrast between his public image innovator, philanthropist, chairman of NASDAQ, and the private reality is just staggering.
Absolutely. And we're going deep today using Diana B. Henriques' amazing book, The Wizard of Lies. Our mission isn't just to rehash the headlines. We want to get into the how and the why. How did he build this illusion? How did he sustain it for decades? And why?
And Henriques is really the perfect guide for this. She's a veteran financial journalist from the New York Times, covered Wall Street for ages, knew the world Madoff moved in. But crucially, she was the only journalist who got extensive face-to-face prison interviews with Madoff after the fall. That access gives her this unique window into his mind, his justifications, however warped they were.
That insight is key. Because this isn't just about numbers. It's about trust, charisma, psychology, and how an illusion was built, maintained, and then, well, spectacularly shattered. Okay, let's unpack this.
The chronological journey.
So let's start at the beginning. Madoff wasn't born into Wall Street royalty or anything. He grew up in Queens, middle-class background.
Right, not the typical image, maybe.
And he started his firm, Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities, back in 1960. Get this, with just
$5,000. $5,000 that he'd apparently saved up himself.
Yeah, from working as a lifeguard and installing sprinkler systems. It has that kind of classic American dream feel at the start, you know, ambition, starting from scratch.
It really does, building something.
And for a long time, a significant part of his business was legitimate. This is really important. He wasn't a fraud from day one, necessarily.
His firm became a major market maker, very respected. They provided liquidity, helped the market function.
He was also an early adopter of technology, using computers for trading, way before many others. He was actually involved in founding NASDAQ.
And served as its chairman multiple times in the early 90s, 1990, 91, 93, I think.
Exactly. So this legitimate success, this reputation, it was gold-plated. It gave him this aura of unimpeachable integrity, the perfect cover, really, for the fraud that was growing alongside it.
And he leveraged that reputation brilliantly, didn't he, to sell the myth, this famous split-strike conversion strategy.
Yes, the secret sauce.
Right. He pitched it as this complex, proprietary method using options and stocks that generated these incredibly steady returns no matter what the market did, like magic.
Sounds impressive.
Except, as Henriques reveals, it was completely made up, total fiction. But that fiction was central to his appeal. People wanted in on Bernie's genius. Access was everything.
So the legitimate success built the stage for the fictional performance. And that brings us to the infamous 17th floor of the Lipstick Building, the secret factory.
This is where Henriques talks about the banality of the fraud. It's chilling, really.
Because it wasn't some super complex scheme happening there.
Not at all. It was shockingly simple, almost clerical work. They had this ancient IBM computer.
Seriously. An old IBM.
Yeah. And a small team led by his right-hand man, Frank DePasquale. They were basically just creating fake trade confirmations, backdating trades on paper to match the returns Madoff promised, generating completely bogus account statements.
Just paperwork. Fabricated paperwork.
Essentially. It was all an illusion, meticulously crafted to look real, but conjured out of thin air. Mundane work, but with utterly devastating consequences. That was his peak. In a way, managing this massive lie.
Core philosophy and values.
So if the trading strategy was fake, what was Madoff actually a master of?
Henriques argues, and I think it's persuasive, that he wasn't a master investor. He was a master salesman of trust.
Selling trust itself.
Exactly. He built this exclusive club. Getting Madoff to manage your money was a status symbol. He tapped into basic human psychology, the halo effect, you know. His NASDAQ chairmanship, his legitimate success, it made people assume everything he did was brilliant and trustworthy.
Blinding them to any red flags.
And affinity fraud, too. He often targeted groups where people already knew and trusted each other, like within the Jewish community or certain charities. That built-in trust made it easier to bypass critical thinking.
It's quite manipulative when you break it down. And what about his mindset later, especially after he was caught? Henriques' prison interviews must shed light on that.
They do. And it's, well, unsettling. She taints a picture of someone utterly lacking remorse.
You know, no remorse at all, even then.
Apparently not. He'd say things like, they were greedy, talking about his victims. I just went along with it. I gave them what they wanted. Or even, I'm a product of the system.
Wow, deflecting blame entirely.
Consistently.
Yeah.
It seems less about pure greed, though obviously that played a role, and more about this insatiable need for admiration, for control, for status. A deep cynicism about the financial system, too.
And an inability to admit failure.
Absolutely critical. He couldn't bear for the illusion to shatter, for his image to crack. So the lies just kept getting bigger, trapping him, until the whole thing inevitably collapsed. The truth just didn't matter anymore.
Three pivotal turning points.
Looking back at his whole trajectory, can we pinpoint maybe three moments that really changed everything for him? Sort of key turning point.
That's a good way to think about it. I mean, the first, arguably, has to be starting the firm in 1960, that legitimate beginning.
Right, the foundation. Without that initial success and reputation, the later fraud wouldn't have been possible on that scale.
Exactly. It set the stage. The second pivotal point is harder to date precisely. But it's the fundamental shift, the decision to move from legitimate market making into running the investment side as a pure Ponzi scheme.
Inventing that split strike story.
Probably around then, yes. When he realized he couldn't deliver the steady returns he promised legitimately, or maybe just didn't want to try, that was the moment he chose deception over admitting any kind of limitation or failure. A critical moral crossing.
Crossing the Rubicon, so to speak.
You could say that. And the third turning point, tragically, has to be the confession in December 2008.
When the financial crisis hit and he couldn't sustain the payouts anymore.
Right. The tide went out, as they say. He knew the game was up and finally confessed to his sons, Mark and Andrew, telling them it was all one big lie. That moment didn't just end the fraud. It detonated his family and unleashed the full scale of the devastation.
Three key moments. The legitimate start, the secret turn to fraud, and the final unavoidable implosion.
Human lessons and reflection.
And Madoff's story isn't just about him. It's also a searing indictment of the systems around him, the enablers.
You mean the regulators, the SEC. Henriques goes into their failures in detail, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. It's one of the most shocking parts of the book. The SEC received numerous credible warnings over the years, most famously from Harry Markopoulos.
The financial analyst who basically figured it out.
Yes, for nearly a decade. Markopoulos handed them detailed, mathematical proof showing Madoff's returns were impossible. He practically gift-wrapped the case for them.
And they just ignored him. Why? How does a regulatory body fail that badly?
It's complex. Maybe incompetence, maybe being intimidated by Madoff's stature, maybe just bureaucratic inertia. But the book suggests a profound systemic breakdown, a real unwillingness to look too closely at a Wall Street titan.
It wasn't just the SEC, though, was it? What about the banks and feeder funds?
Right. Institutions like Fairfield Greenwich and big banks like JP Morgan Chase, they funneled billions to Madoff, collected huge fees in the process.
Were they complicit or just negligent?
Henriques suggests it was likely a spectrum from gross negligence and due diligence to, perhaps, willful blindness. The incentives were all wrong. They made money sending clients to Madoff, so maybe they didn't ask the tough questions they should have.
It paints a picture of a system really poisoned by conflicts of interest and maybe just greed.
And it's so important we don't get lost in the billions in the institutions. We need to remember the human cost, the victims.
Yeah. It wasn't just billionaires, was it?
Not at all. It was teachers, retirees, small business owners, people who lost everything. Their life savings, gone overnight, and hundreds of charities. Elie Wiesel's foundation lost everything.
Just devastating. People who trusted him, often through those community connections you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. The betrayal runs so deep. And it runs right into his own family, too. That confession to his sons.
The ultimate betrayal. Mark and Andrew turned him in, didn't they?
They did. But the public shame, the ostracism, it was immense. Mark Madoff tragically died by suicide 2 years after the arrest. Andrew died later from cancer, which he himself linked to the stress.
It's just heartbreaking. It shows how this kind of lie doesn't just destroy finances. It destroys lives, relationships, everything.
Three final takeaways.
So, reflecting on everything we've discussed, based on Henriques' work, what are the key lessons we should take away? If you had to boil it down for our listeners, let's try for three main insights, maybe an emotional one first.
An emotional insight. I think it has to be the profound, corrosive impact of broken trust, and perhaps the sheer emptiness behind Madoff's pursuit of status. He gained the world, financially speaking, but seemed to have nothing real inside. No empathy, no remorse. It's a chilling reminder of what can happen when image becomes everything.
That's powerful. Okay, what about an intellectual insight? Something about the mechanics or the system?
Intellectually, I think the key takeaway is the disturbing banality of the fraud itself, combined with the spectacular failure of sophisticated systems, both regulatory and institutional, to detect it. It wasn't genius trading. It was basic deception amplified by systemic blindness and misplaced trust. It forces us to question how much we really understand or verify, even when things look legitimate on the surface.
Right. Don't assume complexity means competence or that regulators always catch the bad guys. Okay, and finally, a universal insight, a practical lesson for everyone.
The most universal, I think, goes back to that old saying, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Madoff is the ultimate cautionary tale about the danger of chasing impossible returns, the critical need for genuine due diligence, asking hard questions, demanding transparency, and the wisdom of diversification. Never put all your faith or all your money in one seemingly infallible person or strategy. Healthy skepticism is crucial. And maybe also the importance of moral courage, like Harry Markopoulos showed. Speaking up matters.
Closing narration.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.